What would that be like for all of us? And how would that change our lives? You know, for those of you that were that have been in the teaching profession, the job of a teacher was to bring about significant life change in the people that listened. And as we look at the life of Jesus, we see that in so many different situations. Today we're going to jump into Luke chapter 10, a story that I think is familiar to most of us. As we dive into this story, as we set this story up about the Good Samaritan, the parable is divided around two sets of debate that happened between Jesus and a lawyer. Lawyers don't always get a good rap in our society, but this guy was a sharp lawyer. It's contained in Luke chapter 10, verses 25 through 28 is where we're going to start. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" Jesus said, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" The lawyer answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as you love yourself." "You have answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you will live." So here's the first section of the story. This is kind of the preamble. This is the prelude to the story. And we need to notice a few things about what's going on here in Luke chapter 10. It seems there's an expert in the law, and it seems like he's coming just simply to ask Jesus a question. Verse 25 gives us the indication that the expert has actually come to trap Jesus. There's a discrepancy about what he's about and the way that he comes off. And it's apparent in the first verse. He stands to ask Jesus a question. Now, so it was custom in the day, the teacher or the rabbi would sit, and then those that were coming to learn, they would take the posture of learning, they would actually stand. So in standing, the lawyer is saying to Jesus, "I have an honest question, and I'd really like an honest answer. I'm here to learn from you." But that's not what's happening in this situation. He's there to test Jesus. So in this first round of debate, there are two questions and there are two answers. But you'll notice that it's not a question-answer format, because Jesus knew what was in the heart of this man. Jesus knew that he was being tested. So when the lawyer puts forth the question, the first question, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" Rather than give an answer, what does Jesus do? He gives another question. He asks another question. Jesus did this so often, right? You're expecting an answer from Jesus, and Jesus returns with a question. Now, one of the prevailing assumptions of that day is that you could do something to inherit eternal life. Tragically, this assumption is also all too common today. Jesus recognizes right away that this is at the heart of the question that's being asked, and so he returns with another question. He says, "How do you read the law?" And then there's a series of two answers. The first answer comes from the lawyer himself. Jesus actually has a lawyer answer his own question. And he answers it correctly with the verses out of, you're familiar with it, Deuteronomy chapter 6 and Leviticus chapter 9. Love the Lord with all your, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Now, having given that answer, Jesus now says to him, "You have answered correctly." And then he adds this, "Do this and you will live." Now, that ought to be the end of the story, right? You have answered correctly. Your beliefs are spot on. You have the correct theology. You are a great example of what a Jew, an Orthodox Jew, should be like. But the lingering question still is, does he really have the life to act on it? Is his doctrinal stance in line with the way that he lives his life? Does he really understand that at the heart of this question lies the basic premise that there really is nothing that we can do to inherit eternal life? For some reason, the answer isn't satisfactory to the lawyer. Go figure, right? Perhaps as he says those words out loud, I need to love God and I need to love my neighbor, he realizes that maybe he's gotten himself into a little bit of a problem here. The answer isn't really sufficient. And what Jesus is really saying is, if you want to do something in order to inherit eternal life, what you really must do is to love God continually. Love your neighbor continually with the totality of your being, every moment, every day, your whole life immersed in loving God and in loving others. So as you can imagine, the lawyer gets a little bit nervous at this point, because I think he was hoping that Jesus would just give him a list, right? We all love lists, don't we? He could just check off the list and match up his life and walk away feeling that he had it all together. But instead of giving him a checklist, which works for most of us, Jesus lays out requirements that are limitless.
Put on my coat.
Jesus lays out this command to a radical lifestyle that involves an unlimited, unqualified love for both God and every single person around you. So, starting with verse 29, we enter the second round of debates. And again, two questions and two answers. Here before he was testing Jesus, and here in verse 29 it says, now in order to justify himself. Dallas Willard said that Jesus' parables were there to adjust attitudes in other people. Here we see the attitude of a self-righteous man.
Does it sound weird at all?
He asks the question. I imagine tugging at his collar a little bit, he says, well, who is my neighbor? Because this part of the conversation must have made him a little nervous. It's like he's asked Jesus, who do I need to love? And Jesus says, you need to love people, all people, everywhere, all the time. And so he says back to Jesus, well, Jesus, that's not very helpful. Define people for me. He was looking for a loophole, right? He knew that he was supposed to love God, but who was his neighbor that he was supposed to love with the same care and the same thoughtfulness and the same deference that he loved himself? I want you to know a little bit about the Jewish social structure as it existed in Jesus' day. Starting with the very center of the circle was the priest. That would be the person in the Jewish social structure that had the most influence and the most power. Working outward from there would be the tribe of Levi, the Levites. The Joseph Jew was the next layer out, those who had descended directly from Joseph himself, but were not Levites and were not priests. And then outside of those circles, getting far out, were the untouchables, the tax collectors, the outcasts, the sinners, the Samaritans, and finally, the Gentiles. The question that the lawyer is really asking right now is, how far out of the circle do I need to go? Here's what he's hoping. He's really hoping Jesus is going to say, well, you've got to love the priests, and you've got to love the Levites, and you've got to love, for sure, the Joseph Jew. If Jesus says that, then the lawyer's going to be able to walk away. That works for me. I do that really well. And he'd walk away saying, that man right there, that right there is an amazing teacher. I like that man. But you see, the problem with the lawyer is that he's still living in the do part of the question. What must I do to inherit eternal life? And he doesn't realize that in order to live in the kingdom of heaven, one needs to live a life immersed in love and mercy to every human being that we encounter. He doesn't want to live that way because he wants to take all the credit. He prefers to live by his own intention, by his own ability, so he can present himself as significant and righteous before God. He's asking the question that I think we might be asking today. Do I have to love the people out on the street? Do I have to show mercy to the guy with a cardboard sign that sits every day in front of Walmart? Do I really have to love my in-laws? Do I have to love that annoying coworker beside me, or the difficult neighbor who disregards me, or that friend who has deeply hurt me? Can I just show love to the people who are like me? Or the people who like me? Can I just love those people? Wouldn't that be enough? Jesus is about to blow this lawyer's mind. I'm guessing if there was a way, Jesus would have said, while I answer this question about who your neighbor is, you might want to sit down. Here's what Jesus is going to show him in this particular parable. Jesus is going to absolutely obliterate the circle. Jesus is going to push the envelope all the way out to the extreme, all the way out to the Samaritans. So he takes him slowly and he says, let me tell you a story. It starts in verse 30. Many of you are familiar with the story. In reply to the question, who is my neighbor, Jesus says, in reply to that little Greek phrase, do you know what it means? It doesn't just mean that he answered the question. It means to take up. It means a challenge was thrown down in front of Jesus by the lawyer, and Jesus is going to accept it. Jesus accepts the challenge. Starting in verse 30, going through verse 32, in reply, Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was attacked by robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by the other side. There's a road and there's a situation here. First, the road. We talked about Jericho in our Sabbath school this morning, didn't we? Jericho. The road that goes from Jerusalem to Jericho, some of you know, is steep and twisty and windy. It had earned the nickname the Way of Blood. 17 miles, it descended 3,300 feet. It twisted, it turned, it was steep, it was surrounded by rocky cliffs. It was the perfect place for robbers to hide out. And they would hide out, and they would attack travelers on the road as they passed. The situation is a traveler found himself in a predicament. Robbers had come out, which gives the implication that they took the man's money. They stripped him of his clothes. They beat him. They left him for dead, completely unconscious. That's the situation. And the first two characters of the story arrive on the scene. The first one is a priest coming from Jerusalem to Jericho. We can assume that he has just finished his priestly duties. He'd been serving in the temple. Jericho was a popular resort area for people of the upper class. And so maybe the priest, having finished his temple duties, was now on his way for a little R&R down in Jericho. And it says he saw the man and he passed by on the other side. When it says he walked to the other side of the road, it's really like crossing a person and getting around them on a sidewalk. It's really not a road out like out here on Eastern Avenue. So you get the picture. The priest walks by, he sees him, he goes around the man, and he keeps on walking. The second character comes. He's a Levite. The Levite, they're people that are one step down, again, in social status from the priest, but they still engage in temple duties. They still are a privileged group of people. It's the same pattern for the Levite. It's really the rhythm that was started by the robbers. They all did the same thing. They came upon him, they robbed him, they beat him, and then they walked around him and left. This is really important. There are two types of sin that we see in this story, and it's very important for us to understand both types of sin. There was a sin inflicted by the violence of the robbers. We call this the sin of commission. But according to Jesus, the seemingly greater sin that was committed here, because the story concentrates more on the priest and the Levite much longer than the robbers, it is the sin of neglect, or what we call the sin of omission. You see, their failed opportunity to do good becomes an actual greater evil on their part. Now, the people who are listening to this story along with the lawyer, they're probably getting it up until now. They're probably not surprised that neither one of these characters stop. Here's why. They're imagining themselves in the story. They're clicking off in their own minds all the reasons why they themselves wouldn't stop. Let's talk about a few of these. First of all, the priest or the Levite, actually any Jew, according to ritual law, would be defiled by a corpse if they touched a dead body. For a priest, this was a big deal. I mean, to be restored to a clean status in order to re-enter into the duties at worship, they would have to go through all kinds of time and take lots of money, and they would have to go through all kinds of humiliating processes. Personal safety was an issue. It was a common practice amongst the robbers of that day to actually use one of their own as a decoy. You know, a robber who would look all beaten up and who needed help. And they would wait until the traveler stopped, and then they would rob that person. So for very good reason, the priest or the Levite, maybe this was a robber, so why take a chance? There were also social barriers that must have been going on in the minds of the listeners and the minds of the characters as to why they wouldn't help this man. Again, the Jewish people had a long list of people who they could and couldn't hang out with. It was a long list of who they couldn't help, and everybody that they couldn't help were people who were non-Jews. Time, another consideration. There's all the time that it's going to take. He's been working hard. He's on his way to vacation. He'd been taking time out of his busy schedule. That's not an item in his Outlook or in his, you know, reminder list in his iPhone. And then money. It's going to cost money. He's going to have to use some of his own provisions, certainly, in taking care of this man in need is going to cost him some money. So unfortunately, the priest and the Levite find that they have become prisoner to their own belief system. They attend the right church. They believe all the 28 fundamental beliefs, but their dogma doesn't impact the way that they live their lives. Rather, the rules that they cherish have wrapped their cords so tightly around their hearts that there is no room for compassion. The first person that walks by, it makes all the sense in the world, the priest. The second person was a Levite. And now they're all anticipating who the third person is going to be. Who's it going to be, right? The Joseph Jew, of course. They're all kind of excited because, well, they're all just your standard everyday Jews. And so maybe they can relate to the hero of the story. What's going to happen next? And Jesus takes the person that they're expecting to be the villain in the story. And he turns him into the hero. There were no all kinds of animosity between the Jews and the Samaritans. Some of you know some of the animosity. Josephus, in his classic work, The History of the Jewish People, writes that daily petitions were offered by Jews in the temple praying to God that Samaritans might not be partakers of eternal life. The animosity, as some of you know, goes back hundreds of years, back to the time of Ezra, when the Babylonians invaded Jerusalem and they took captive the temple and the town and they took all the cream of the crop of Jewish people and they exiled them for 70 long years. And while those Jewish people were gone, you remember the story how the Jews who were left for that 70 years began to intermarry with the Gentiles. And when the pure-blooded people came back to rebuild the temple, to rebuild the city, to rebuild their homes, this group of half-breed Jews came back to help. But their offer of help was rejected, and the Jewish people completely cut off from Jewish society, this group of people that they labeled as Samaritans. How would this story be told if Jesus were here this morning? Maybe he would tell us the story of the good Muslim or the good atheist. Maybe he would tell us the story of the good LGBTQ activist or the good politician. For some of you, the good MAGA Republican, or for others of you, the good woke Democrat. But here's the shock value. The people were expecting one thing, and the most unthinkable person, the most unthinkable person comes in not as the villain, but as the hero of the story. This Samaritan who walks by the wounded man has the same list of reasons why he should not be stopping to help this man. He had the same excuses. But something had happened in the heart of the Good Samaritan. Something happened to break the cycle of sin and violation, because inside the heart of this Samaritan lay a heart of compassion. Why? Why was it that the religious leaders of the day did not have this, but the Samaritan did? In order to have a heart of compassion that he had, somewhere along the line, instead of being cynical, instead of being angry and bitter about being an outsider, he instead drew near to the heart of God. When you do that, in a crisis, Dr. Eric Walsh talked about this, how God does his best work in the midst of a crisis. When you do that in a crisis in your life, in a difficult situation in your life, God grows a heart of compassion in you. The Samaritan came to the man. He saw the man. He had compassion on the man. In order to really love people, we have to do that. We have to pause. We have to pay attention. We have to go to them. We have to take risk. We have to place ourselves in a vulnerable position. In order to love people, we need to move towards them, even when it's not convenient, when it's risky, when we're nervous, when we're not sure of the outcome. Now, while they're still reeling with the idea that the Samaritan is going to be the hero, that the pattern has been broken, that compassion moves you towards someone that's wounded, Jesus gets real concrete. He goes to a great deal of detail to describe the acts of compassion of this Samaritan. He plumbs the depth of risk that this man took. He went to him. He came near to him. He showed compassion. He bound up the man's wounds, which means he touched the bloody wounds. He bandaged them to stop them from bleeding. He put his hands on this man. He poured oil and wine, which were standard first aid remedies in the first century. Wine to disinfect, oil to soften and protect the wound. And then it says he put him on his donkey, which means he got off of it. He put the man on the animal, carrying him this 17-mile journey, this hot desert descent. He took him and led him to the inn. It translated in many translations as take, but literally, correctly understood, it actually means he actually led the man on this animal. Huge implications in the Middle East. In the Middle East, your social status determined who rode and who walked. Nobody in a higher social class would have walked while somebody in a lesser social caste rode. The Samaritan gets off his donkey. He puts the man on it and he takes the posture of a servant in doing so. And he cares for him at the inn overnight, meaning he had to change his plans. He had to give up whatever it was he was going to do in order to take the time to take care of this man. In the morning, he gives the innkeeper money to take care of the man, which obligates the innkeeper to take care of him. 2 days' wages is the amount that he gave the innkeeper. And then he promises to return. He promises to reimburse him for any additional expenses. It was kind of like he left his Visa card or a blank check. He says, whatever it is that you need to take care of this man, you have my permission. You have my money. I will come back. I would love to have been there at this point in the story, wouldn't you? They hear what I imagine must have been a hush so strong that you could hear every single beat of everyone's heart. Because you see, Jesus does not answer the question, who is my neighbor? In this round of debate, there's still one question and two answers that still need to happen. In verse 36, Jesus reshapes the lawyer's question and says this: which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? The lawyer wanted a list. He wanted Jesus to tell him how many people and what kind of people he had to love in order to achieve righteousness, in order to inherit eternal life. Jesus can't give him a list because it's way too narrow. So Jesus gives him this expansive answer: to whom must you become a neighbor? You see, love does not begin by defining its objects. Are you hearing me? Love does not begin by defining its objects. Love begins by discovering its objects. You and I can't know in the morning who our neighbor will be throughout the day, because we live in the day. God will reveal that person to us during the day. Jesus gives to this man a dynamic concept about who his neighbor actually is. We must become a neighbor to anyone in need, Jesus says. The lawyer is asking desperately, what must I do to get in? And what Jesus is actually telling him is what one who is already in looks like. You see the difference? The lawyer is asking Jesus to answer the question, what works can I do? And Jesus says instead, let me show you the fruit of a person whose heart has been radically transformed by the love of Christ. Then let me show you when someone comes alongside with a heart of compassion and their heart is changed by God's heart, what they do when they come across someone who is broken, who is wounded. There are two answers in verse 37. The expert in the law replied. Listen to how he replies. The one who had mercy on him, of course. You notice he doesn't actually call him a Samaritan. He couldn't even get the words out, because he knew that there was no other answer but to quibble further at this point would have been to reveal in front of everyone his own lack of compassion. So he stammers out the words, obviously, the one who had mercy. And Jesus gives the final answer. The passage ends with these words. Jesus told him, go and do likewise. And I will end today with those same words. As you leave this building today, go and do likewise.